history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some pretty extraordinary stories to tell if we only take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're always entertained, and so often inspired by these stories. And I don't think we can squeeze all the stories in today from the legendary Air Force career of General Robert Titus. Earthquake, as he's known to some. We'll see if we can figure out where that nickname came from. But let's go back. I know you just celebrated your 90th birthday here in Colorado Springs, Colorado, home, of course, of the Air Force Academy. But take me back to your childhood. You lived a few different places on the East Coast. Do you remember early on getting fascinated or enthralled with the idea of aviation?
Well, early on, I suppose, was about my first flight in an airplane. I guess I was about 7 years of age when my father took me out to visit an airfield locally in Hagerstown, Maryland, where I started the third grade. Moved there when I was 7 years old. There was a fellow with a Waco single-engine biplane, two open cockpits, and I sat in my father's lap in the back cockpit, and that was the experience. I thought it was a good idea. I remember walking past the post office on the way home from school, and there was a big poster out on a board in front saying, "Be a flying cadet." And there's a picture of airplanes over Randolph Field, Texas. I thought that seemed like a good idea. And, of course, I grew up reading G8 and his Battle Aces and Eddie Rickenbacker in the Flying Circus. But opportunities seemed distant, and I didn't dwell on that. In my recollections, I was aware of the fact that it would be a great thing to do to get up in airplanes. But it was sometime later that the opportunity came to me.
Well, I'm kind of struck by the irony here because I think about all the pilots I've talked to over the years who chuckle at paratroopers and say they don't know why anyone would want to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. And you started out as a paratrooper, ended up as a legendary pilot. And if you would have listened to everybody else, I guess you would have been in the Navy because you went to high school in a Navy town.
I did indeed. But I had no interest in being in the Navy, to tell you the truth. I actually enlisted in the chief petty officer, loaded up with gold braid, talked to me about how I was going to enjoy the Navy, and I told him I wasn't interested in the Navy, as I say. So he sent me off to infantry basic training, which was fine with me. They were looking for paratroopers, and actually I was a bit too tall. The limit was supposed to be 6 foot, and so I kind of scrooched down on the scale, and the sergeant was saying, "Oh, no, you got to stand up straight." And the captain said, "No, we'll take him." So I went through jump school, and I ended up in the 82nd Airborne Division. The war ended while I was in training. The 82nd had redeployed from Europe to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I marched in the World War II Victory Parade, never having heard a shot fired or been overseas. The 82nd was the World War II Victory Parade from Washington Square in New York all the way up to Central Park. Great event.
Well, those are some memories for you. Speaking of memories, how about December 7th, 1941? Were you in Norfolk that day?
I was. We were walking. I and a couple of my buddies were walking along and heard about it on the radio, I suppose. And we were talking about how we were going to beat the Japs and so on. We walked by an apartment building, and a woman opened a window and said, "You boys don't understand what war is all about. This is not interesting. This is not a good thing." And we were chagrined, I guess, by our immaturity. But, you know, we were fired up because, as all young men, think there's some glorious opportunity in a war. Little did we know.
Well, you have perspective on multiple wars now, but you mentioned marching in that victory parade, and that had to be quite a sight. I mean, to see the people lined up on the streets of New York, I can't imagine how unique that was. Was there some disappointment on your part that you didn't get to go overseas and be a part of it?
Well, I was looking forward to it. In fact, at Fort Bragg, we were lining up to, before I went, the 82nd came back, before the war ended, we were in advanced airborne training in the Alabama area of Fort Benning. They were forming up a new airborne division, presumably to jump into Japan. And I recall, again, on the radio, hearing about the atomic bombs going off, and figured, that's probably a better deal. I don't know that I would have enjoyed jumping into combat in Japan.
Well, And you have perspective from what you did in Korea and Vietnam and time in the Pentagon and at the highest levels of our military. But when you look back on that, do you feel that the atomic bomb and President Truman's decision saved your life?
I can't say that I ever gave it any consideration. Had the opportunity presented itself, I'd have been happy to go with the troopers, I suppose, and engage in combat and try to win the war. That's what we were being trained to do, and I don't think that very many of us were anxious to go or uninterested, but, you know, we'd have done what we were told to do.
Well, and I guess you didn't know at the time either that eventually you would have the chance to come down behind enemy lines and fight your way back across. Not that that's what your plan was.
No.
How did you go from 82nd Airborne to Air Force pilot?
Well, when I got out of the Army, I went to Virginia Tech to study engineering. I was ready to get out of there. I met an Air Force recruiter, and he said, "We're looking for pilots." And they offered me an opportunity to go to pilot training. Okay, if I could pass the physical. I said, "What's the deal?" I said, "Well, we're looking for pilots. We'll put you into pilot training. If you make it, we'll keep you and give you commission. And if you don't, we don't want you." And I thought, my goodness, this is a no-brainer for me. You're going to teach me to fly, and if I flunk out, I just go home. No charge, no commitment. I'll sign up. And that's what happened. I went through pilot training and was commissioned and got my wings. And shortly thereafter, they gave a war for me, as I saw it.
How did you receive that news of war?
I was in New York. I had flown up there in a P-51 Mustang to meet a girl that I knew. And the following Sunday, I was ready to leave town. And I was headed out to Floyd Bennett Field, where I'd parked the airplane. And I heard the news that the war started in Korea, and I was anxious to get involved, and I kept applying. It took me about a year before they finally, I was essential where I was told. We were flying Mustangs and making blips for a radar controller school down at Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. I kept going over to personnel saying, "I want to sign up for an assignment in the war." Well, finally, a year or so later, I got orders to go to Luke Field and shoot a little gunnery and then head over to Korea. As it turned out, I got waylaid and sent to Japan for about 3 months. And again, I was still trying to get into the war in Korea, and I kept contacting friends of mine over there. And finally, a fellow by the name of Rock Brett, who was the ops officer of one of the fighter squadrons, went to his group commander, who in turn put in a name request for me. As a result of that, I got called in by the colonel, who my group commander, and told me that I was going out of channels, and that was totally unauthorized and unacceptable. He said, "However, you've got the group gunnery records. Maybe you can do some good over there, so I'm going to let you go."
Why was that so important to you? Why did you so doggedly pursue that assignment?
I had in my blood the image of myself as a fighter pilot, and fighter pilots do what they do in war. And as I said, when I was a kid, I read lots of books, G8 and His Battle Aces and Eddie Rickenbacker, Fighting the Flying Circus, and I just felt that's where I should be. As long as there was a war and I was a pilot and I was a fighter pilot and what I considered to be a pretty good fighter pilot, I wanted to be involved. I thought that was my job.
And you have flown most of the fighter aircraft that the Air Force has had in its nearly 70-year history as the U.S. Air Force. Are you still kind of partial to that Mustang?
Oh, yeah. As I tell my good friend up in Denver, who's a tax attorney and owns a Mustang and races at Reno, he also owns a Sea Fury, and he asked me one time what I thought of the Mustang, and I told him, what else can you think of about it when you understand it's the best airplane that God ever allowed to be built? Yeah, it's a great airplane, and that and the Sabre jet were my favorite.
Well, and you flew them both in Korea, 101 combat missions in Korea. Do I have that number right?
So I understand. I didn't pay much attention, but they told me you already flew 100 and you got to go home.
What kind of missions were those? I mean, that's a lot. That's
flying the Mustangs, it was mostly ground support and interdiction, flying up the main supply routes, looking for trucks or anything coming down into the battle area to keep the supplies from the enemy getting to the front. And a lot of close air support for the Army on the ground and the Marines, dropping bombs and napalm and strafing to assist our comrades on the grounds, and a very noble mission. Close support is a very fine mission because you work so close to the troops, we used to say. The 40s and 50s will get you in the coolant, and then the day's over.
How did you handle that, the pressure and precision that those kind of missions required?
You know, you just get yourself, your teeth into it, as it were. You're so intent on providing the best support you can and keeping the enemy suppressed and their fire suppressed, that you just get into it. It's like when you're playing football. You get into the game, and you're just one with the environment. You just get yourself so heavily involved in it that you haven't got anything else better to do. You just want to do the best you possibly can.
I'll apologize in advance for asking any dumb questions, but it occurs to me in a situation like that where you're providing such close support for ground troops that there's that ever-present possibility of friendly fire, injuries, and deaths. Was that something that weighed on you?
Well, you were very careful. I mean, you talked to the forward air controller on the ground who'd be there with the Jeep, and they laid out some colored panels to identify their position, and they were pretty precise in identifying where you could put the ordnance and what you needed to avoid. I never had any problem in finding the target. I know that were friendly fire incidents. I was never associated with such activity. I suppose that there's some guys in the situation get careless by virtue of the fact that they're concerned for their own safety and welfare. But I didn't allow that to influence my attitude.
How did you feel about your own safety and welfare? Did you think you were doing something dangerous?
You know, sometimes you get butterflies in your belly on the way to the target, but when you get to where you're, when you get into the hostile environment, again, you're so busy, you're so involved, you haven't got time to think about your own personal welfare. It's just not within the equation of your thought process.
And you had targets, but you were a target. How frequent was anti-aircraft fire from the ground or maybe even enemy fighters?
Well, no enemy fighters when we were flying Mustangs down at the, they were too far away. There were some that had occasionally been involved with that activity before the stabilized the demilitarized zone, as it was when I was there. So there was no evidence or any indication of enemy aircraft activity, but there was an awful lot of ground fire, and I got hit quite a few times. Every time I bring the airplane home, the sergeant would be looking at it, and he'd look at me and say, "You got my airplane, a hole in my airplane again, sir." And say, "Sorry about that."
Did that ever get to you? The holes in the airplane? Realizing how many there were or where they were and how close you came to being shot down?
I remember one incident where I felt the blast of some kind of a projectile, and the airplane bounced, and I smelled cordite, and I thought, I'm done. And I called my wingman and said, I'm hit, and I'm headed out. And I looked at all my instruments. Everything was fine. I thought, what in the world is this? I had some rockets on board, and I thought, well, I'm going back and shoot up that target again. And I did. But apparently there's no damage to the airplane. It's the strangest thing. Only experience I ever had like that. You know, it startled me.
Sure.
You know, trying to sort out what I was going to do. I wasn't terrified of anything, as I recall. When you get it and you have to bail out, then you do that too.
Did you ever have to do that in the 51?
Yeah. I got hit, and I didn't realize I was hit until the engine started heating up. Obviously, the coolant had leaked out, and had gone and hit the peg, and the airplane started to burn, and I was forced to bail out. I just went out over the edge, and I was a lot lower than I thought I was, apparently, because I pulled the ripcord and the parachute opened and I hit the ground almost all at once. I didn't know where I was. Nobody else saw me bail out. They thought I was gone. When I got home, I didn't show up. Anyway, it turns out I was in the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, and I was between the enemy and the friendly forces in this no man's zone. I tried to orient myself and looked up, and there were guys from the north coming toward me, guys in quilted pajamas, and I thought, they're not the right kind of guys for me. I had my .45, and I fired a couple of shots, and then I heard a burp gun or two, and I thought, whoa, this is not too good. So I hunkered down in the hole, and then when a short time later, I heard a voice that said, keep your head down and crawl this way. A good American voice. The Marines sent out a patrol, laid down suppressing, covering fire, and I crawled over and ended up in a bunker and hitchhiked my way home.
Wow. So all these times that you've been there for the ground forces, now they're here for you.
Yeah, they saw me. The airplane crashed and the parachute opened when you hit the ground. They said, boy, that was close. You almost didn't make it. I said, well, almost is not good enough, is it?
Wow.
I got home. The main supply route where they delivered ordnance and supplies to the front lines ran right through my base, K-46. It wasn't very far south of there. And I got home and the guys already, I said, okay, who's got my shaving brush? They already divvied up my stuff.
Were you able to get it all back?
Yeah.
Did that experience change your perspective after that on future missions?
I can't say that had anything to do with it. I mean, I simply accept it. I've been accused all my life of having a very level personality. I never get too excited about anything. I mean,
not even Air Force football?
Oh, you know how those things go. Yeah, it's always exciting to see something interesting occur. Yeah, I've seen some interesting things, but I can't say that it affected my performance.
His performance, in the eyes of the Air Force, was enough to merit the Distinguished Flying Cross four times over, the Silver Star, even the Air Force Cross, not to mention countless other decorations. And we'll hear about some of those as General Titus transitions from those propeller-driven Mustangs to early Air Force jets when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.